And then we talked this morning a little bit about some Sabbath miracles, and that was fun to talk a little bit about that. We didn't quite get through that. So what I want to do is pick up on that, and then I want to finish what I didn't finish last night at the end of that, okay? So this is going to kind of be like a smashed fruit smoothie here, you know. We're going to put the two together. And I had planned to do that anyway, but we kind of ran out of time this morning. So we were looking at the Sabbath miracles and how the Lord wanted to bring and loved to bring healing on the Sabbath. And I've been most gratified to hear some of your comments and different things about how you're processing this issue of bitterness and how you're some of you have moved through that. And I appreciate the testimonies that you've shared with me. It's really helped me grow as well. Now, under the experience of the man with the withered hand, we were developing that theme. I remember that this morning. And we were talking about the withered hand being likened unto the right hand, it told us in Luke. And those two ministries coming together, the health ministry and ministers and physicians working together. And other people within congregations, and I shared a few testimonies with you on that. We want to move now next to our next Sabbath miracles that I have for us to consider, and that's in John chapter 9. John chapter 9, probably one of my favorite Sabbath miracles in the Bible. We have, of course, the story of the man who had been blind from birth. And we're just going to read a few verses here of it. Now, as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. And so what did he do? He explained a few things, and then he gave him something very simple to do, verse 6. And when he had said these things, he spat on the ground and made clay with the saliva, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. And of course, what day was this? Verse 14. Now, it was the Sabbath when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Now, you know, the thing that strikes me about this, and of course we could preach a whole message on any one of these parables, is the simplicity of the things that Jesus many times asked people to do. Have you ever noticed that the things that our Lord asks us to do are many times, in and of themselves, not that complex? How many of you have ever noticed that? In fact, they're relatively easy, but how many of you have noticed that even though they're relatively, supposedly easy, they seem to be very difficult for us to do? And we sometimes like to minimize them like Naaman did and say, you know, I don't know about this dipping in the river, and, you know, isn't our river better, and can't we, you know, he kind of had it all messed up, and he took the earth back from his country, and he said, okay, and he had all these things going on. But the Lord asked him to do something simple, and he asks us the same kind of things, to just demonstrate a simple faith. And he's the one that's given us the measure of faith, even, that tells us in Romans. And so in this particular passage, what I wanted to bring out is the simplicity of some things. And many times when we study and we get involved in medicine and we get involved in studying of any field, we complicate issues. I remember living with my grandfather when he turned 86 years old. How many of you have ever lived with somebody that's 60 years older than you are? How many of you know that that's a great blessing? Grandfather moved in with me, and he moved from Walla Walla. He was unable to live alone, and so he called me up on the phone and he said, I want to come live with you. I said, what about my dad? He said, no, don't want to live with him. He won't let me do what I need to do. And I think I'd have more success with you. I said, okay, well, let me think about it. He says, all right, you think about it. Would you go out and check the mail, because I sent you a check today. I sold my house. I sent you the money already. I want you to buy me a house. I went out, and in the mailbox, there was a check for the amount that he had sold his house for, minus what he needed to move. So I went and bought a house. And my grandfather moved in with me. And what? I was somewhat nervous about this. But the simple faith of my grandfather was a great blessing to me. 60 years older than me. He came and looked at me, and he started to watch me, and he said, "You know, he didn't say this, he just looked this way. You do things that you shouldn't do." Like, one of the things I did back then was that I played football. Still occasionally can do that, but not as often with the girls. You know, a 3-month-old just can't catch very well, at least last week. And the 3-year-old. And so I was out there to play football, and he came, and I said, "We're going to go play football." He goes, "Well, what?" I said, "Football." And he says, "Okay, I'm going. I'll go with you." He went with us, and he sat there by the field. And I can remember, we go to the first huddle, and how am I going to include my grandfather? He's out there with his big coat on in the middle of the field in the fall, and he's sitting there, and he kind of looks like, he is a patriarch, and he's sitting there in the middle of the ball field. It was just an unusual sight. And, the other team was saying, "Hey, is he your quarterback?" And, they were kind of joking around, and he didn't hear him, so he didn't laugh. You know, just looked. And he was watching me like, how am I included? So I said, "Man, we better go huddle around grandfather. That's what we'll do to start the game, and we'll have him, say whatever he wants to say to us." And so we went over there, and I said, "Grandfather, we want to just pray before we begin." And he goes, "I think that's a very good idea." So then he began to pray, and he just said, "Lord, these boys they're troubled. They are doing troubling things. And they could injure themselves a lot. And Lord, what for? What for, Lord?" So bless them. Amen. And all the guys just kind of, they just looked at each other. And this began a relationship between me, my grandfather, and that team. And when we lost the championship, he was there to pick us up. And then he went into the basketball season, and then he was in all the team pictures. And so we just had this relationship. And grandfather always was moving us with his prayers. At the end, at the end of the season, he goes, "Lord, I pray this is the last season for these boys. This was dangerous." And he was just always, but he never was, never was pushy. And I would have to take grandfather to different places to get care. He'd go down and he was ailing a little bit more. He had a little congestive heart failure that was developing and different things. I remember I took him in to see the doctor. So I took him to see the doctor, and of course I'm an emergency room nurse, and I knew the doctor and different things. I went in and I said, "My grandfather is putting this stuff on his foot. He doesn't need it, but would you tell him not to put it on because it stinks?" And this and that. And I told him in the hall, like I was supposedly Mr. Professional, and that he was going to listen to me. Well, he was a wise doctor. So he goes in, and he talks to my grandfather, and he says, "So, tell me about yourself and different things." And then grandfather says, "Yeah, I'm putting, my toe's been hurting me, and I've been putting a little ointment on it." "Well, what you been putting on?" "Absorbine Junior." How many of you know what Absorbine Junior is? That stuff is some really rank smelling stuff. It doesn't absorb much at all. It's absorbing, but it's definitely not absorbable. I didn't think. It was very aromatic, at least the batch my grandfather had. And, I'm behind him. I'm going to the doctor. And the doctor looks at my grandfather, and he looks at me. And he says, "Elder McIntosh, I really think that's good for your toe." I'm going, "No! No! No!" And he goes, I really think it is." And then he moved on in the exam. I was like, what in the world? I'm not even taking my grandfather to the doctor anymore if this is where it's going. Sort of tongue in cheek. And at the end, the doctor says, "Hey, can I talk to you for just a minute?" And then he said to me, "Anything your grandfather rubs on his feet, anything he rubs there is probably going to help the circulation, don't you think? So let's just let him rub anything he wants to on his feet." And I thought about it. I said, that was wise. Just a simple thing that grandfather, there was no reason to take him away from that thing that was giving him comfort. And so what I began to learn from a grandfather was this whole idea that the simple sometimes is better. I would come home with these highfalutin ideas from various gurus and gurus and whatever kangaroos that wrote books about how to do ministry and how to hop over here and do this and, you know, gospel puppets and gimmicks and tricks and balloons and bells and whistles. You know, that was before it was ever at any Seventh-day Adventist church at all. It was still all at the circus, and it was moving into the other churches. And you know, I'd show these things, and I'd come home and I would bring those to him, and he would just be sitting there in his easy chair. And he would, right next to me, had this whole set of testimonies, volume 1 through 9, and then this conflict series and all that stuff right next to him, and he was rereading it. And so as I'd come home, I'd tell him all about, he'd say, "What'd they teach you today over there?" And I'd tell him, and he would never say anything much unless I asked him. I said, "What do you think of that? Do you think that's a good idea?" And he'd always point, he goes, "Give me volume 4. Turn to page 300. And he didn't say it then. "Turn to page 300 and read that for me." And then he asked me, "What do you think of that?" When it came to small groups, he showed me things about cottage meetings. When it came to other things, he showed me other things. How many think that was a great blessing? And just the simple way of answering the questions, they really helped me. So, simple remedies. In John 9, I know we could talk a lot about the blindness and different things. But you know, it's the simple things in our walk with the Lord that define whether or not we're really with Him. And many times, you know, in an era, I think, where people are dumbing down the gospel. And I can't say that everybody's doing that. I think there are many godly people in the Adventist church and other churches. I think God has people everywhere. Don't you think that's true? But I think in this era where people are tempted to dumb down, the gospel becomes cheapened and people are underwhelmed by it. Are you with me? After September 11, when that tragedy came to America, 56,000 people signed up for the American Red Cross. They said, "We will help." After Hurricane Ivan is now coming, there's thousands more joining up, and they're saying, "Hey, there's something here significant." People don't want just the minimal. They want something that's worth something. Are you with me? I learned this when I was dating my wife. Started to date my wife, and her father did not like me. Also, the first father who hadn't liked me, so I was kind of used to that. But I was serious about this, and he did not like me at all. But he just put me through the rigors. That's another story. 5 years later, he finally gave his permission. Eat your hearts out, ladies. No one's going to wait for you maybe that long. No, they will. I'm just kidding you. I shouldn't have said that. But, man, I tell you, I look back on that, and I woke up and it wasn't Leah, nothing like that. Still the right one. And if your name's Leah, I'm sorry, just a Bible story, it's nothing against you. But I got to tell you that the things that we have to, what would you say, wait for are important. The small things, simple things like that. Now, with Jesus here, he said, just make some clay, a poultice, and different things. And in our Christian walk, sometimes he does as well. I want to tell you a story about Sam in this regard, and then we'll go to our next one. Sam was studying with me, and he was a Buddhist monk. How many of you have ever studied with a Buddhist monk? That's a pretty interesting situation. You know, I said, "Sam, you must be born again." And he said, "I have been many times." And explained to me that he was born many different times, and I was like, "What do I do now?" You know, so I'm back to the drawing board, and I started studying different things with him, and then I said, "Man, this is going to take forever with Sam," so gave him to a lay person, and I was going to have to be gone on some different things, and the lay person worked with him, and finally he came all the way through different studies and different things, and the man came up to me and said, "I think Sam may be ready. He wants to be baptized on this day. These are the dates that would work for him this year," but they were like months apart. So I went over to visit him, and Sam was still wearing about, I don't know, 3 or 4 golden rings. How's that song? 4 golden rings or something like that. Anyway, I don't know how many it was. And he was reading those, you know, and of course, as a Seventh-day Adventist minister, raised the fourth generation, Seventh-day Adventist minister, I knew that there were the issue of decorum and these kind of things, you know, you need to talk about that. But I had no relationship with him at all, so I said, well, I'm not going to talk to him about that. I'm just going to pray about it. I'm going to pray about it. I'm just going to go home. I'm going to pray. By the way, I've learned that that's a very good thing. You know, I've learned that if you pray, the Holy Spirit is in touch with people. How many of you have learned that? And many times, you don't have to say anything. And take it from me, someone who makes a living saying all kinds of things, it's better to say less. And anyway, so I went back to Sam. And so I said, what am I going to do? How am I going to get at this? So I'm going to study the Ten Commandments with Sam again, just to go through that, because he really liked the Ten Commandments. It was kind of like the 8 noble truths, you know, and he was like, wow, that's cool, you know. And so I went back and I began studying these Ten Commandments with him. Thou shalt have no other gods. And then I went through and showed how many different people had idols and how those idols could be this and that. And I showed him this. And some of this had to do with adornment and about how they were, wearing these things that actually had gods or in them and different things. And it was, you know, I showed him the different cultures like Egypt, about how these things were related to all that, different things. And you know, a couple of weeks later, he just came to me at church and he says, I think my rings are idols. I said, you do? He said, yeah. I said, well, why don't you talk to me? Well, I'll get together. I want to hear what that means to you. So I got together with him, and he began to talk to me. And he said, and he showed me what he thought about that. And he says, what do you think? And I said, well, I think anything. If we're not willing to give anything out for the Lord, this could be a real problem. And, I showed him some other texts that I thought about that. And he says, I wanted to get baptized on all those different days. And maybe you don't know this, but in my culture, there are these different days that are called auspicious days. And those were the days that were just related to various gods. And if I would have gotten baptized on that day, it would have been sort of like worshiping that God. And I went, whoo. And he said, and you know, the other thing, I feel like I got to tell you this, and I didn't even know this was a problem, but come down to the basement with me. So I went down to the basement with him. You know, I don't usually go to the basement in Bible studies. Never learned that at Amazing Facts or the seminary or anything. There's nothing holy about the basement. And in fact, Daniel went to the upper room to have his devotional life, so I usually stay upstairs. And so I went to the basement with him, and he opened up this cupboard. And you know what was in that cupboard? 4 little gold Buddhas that he was worshiping. Now, why did I tell you that story? Jesus and the healing of this man on the Sabbath asked him to just do a very simple thing. And the Lord sometimes asks us to do simple, seemingly insignificant things. Did you know that? As an Adventist pastor, he asked me somehow to talk to people about things that sometimes are very difficult to talk about because I don't ever want to be on the spot or this or that. How many think it was a good idea that I talked to Sam or prayed that the Lord would talk to Sam? How many think that was a good idea? How many think it would have been wise to go ahead and baptize him while he was worshiping the 4 Buddhas and had the 4 golden rings and 7 lords of leaping probably in some other room? And so I think what the Lord is wanting to do, you know, many times in this era of trying to dumb down and take away things, it's kind of like when I used to sneak out to the garage and take something out of my dad's toolbox. It was a small thing, maybe an Allen wrench or a Steve wrench or, you know, whatever, you know, some kind of wrench or something. This is a small thing.
And then Dad would go out, and it never even now ceases to amaze me that he would get his toolbox, and the very thing that I took out, that's what he needed. How many of you have ever had that experience? Where's the third Allen wrench, Don? You know, and then I'm grounded and everything. But, you know, seriously, I think before we take away anything that we see in the Bible or the spirit of prophecy, we need to remember that that's God's toolbox. We might not understand what it's for. We might not understand, well, what's that for, Dad? That looks like something I can... My daughter is now just learning this. And I am a much poor disciplinarian than my... Last time I came home, she had all my pens on the floor spread out like logs at a log burling contest. Then next she had her Legos. Then next she had her marbles. The only problem was I discovered this at nighttime. I stepped in the front door. I rolled on the pens. I fell backwards on the Legos. And the marbles, my head hit in the middle and it went all over. Anyway, her mother and they all woke up, and of course then it was my fault that I woke them up. Anyway, you figure that out. But the simple things. Jesus asked for simple things, and sometimes those simple things are profound in their implications. Let's go to our next miracle. Luke chapter 13, Matthew, Mark, and then Luke. In Luke chapter 13... Verse 10 through 17. We have another Sabbath miracle. And we have a picture given there. Am I in the wrong place? Yes. 13. 10 through 17. Now he was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath. And behold, there was a woman who had a spirit of infirmity 18 years and was bent over and could in no way raise herself up. But when Jesus saw her, he called her to him and said to him, "Woman, you are loose from your infirmity." And he laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made straight and glorified God. The ruler of the synagogue answered with indignation because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath. And he said to the crowd, "There are 6 days on which men ought to work. Therefore come and be healed on them and not on the Sabbath day." The Lord then answered and said, "Hypocrite, does not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or his donkey from the stall and lead it away to water it? So ought not this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound, think of it, for 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath?" You love that story? Well, there's a couple of very practical things about that story as I've thought over it over the years. First of all, the thing that strikes me is that this woman must have gone to many places to get healing before. This woman must have had problems for a long 18 years. Can you think of that? 18 years. Now, maybe you have chronic pain. Maybe you deal with that. That's a long time. I mean, some of you may be ending up going into some kind of place where you're dealing with people that have pain all the time. But I tell you, you never... People coming into the emergency room, the ones that had, you know, you just felt for them as they were kind of coming across like this and they could hardly move. You know what I'm talking about? And it looks like they're sneaking in there. You know, they're kind of sneaking across and they're just in all kinds of pain. And this lady was like that. And this reminds me of the story of when I was working in ER. And this person had come in and one shift and had terrible neck pain. Thought maybe it was a torticollis or some kind of problem at the neck. And so the first doctor, he was a lightning quick doctor. His name was Vaughn. And he would come in there and he would just... Vaughn Cornell was his name. He would come in there and he would just get patients in and out. And so he ordered some x-rays. Nothing showed up. And so he sent them with some muscle relaxants on the way. Well, the next time he came in, and I was still on the next shift when he came in again, the person came back that next day, still in all kinds of pain, and this time another doctor saw them. in order this time, more tests. And then the next one came in. And for 4 days in a row, this person came in each time I was on, and I had all those charts, and I had been the one. Then the patient came in the next day. This time it was Dr. Keegstra who was working. And Dr. Keegstra was kind of one of those old sage doctors. You know, he kind of looked like Kris Kringle. You know, he kind of looked like Santa Claus. And he had this big beard, and he and I would discuss the philosophy of philosophy and philosophize about philosophizing, and we would just, you know, we would break it down. And he was very thoughtful, and he was methodical, but, you know, he could move too if he needed to. This time he went in there, and this person was there and had this terrible pain, and was like this, and was kind of looking all at us, and what, you know, and spoke Espanol, broken English, different things. And so Dr. Keegstra looked at the assortment of charts now, almost ready to be published in book form. And he looked through those charts and he began to sit down and he just began to ask that person questions and questions and questions and questions. And the guy was saying, "Can't you give me something for the pain?" And all this and on and on. Finally, the guy said, he said, "Have you taken any medicine other than what you've had at the hospital?" He said, "Yeah, when this first started, I went down the street, broken English, I went down the street and I got some medicine from my friend." Oh! How do you think that's a good idea? Especially if you can't read English. So he went down and got this medicine. He took this medicine. And it was some kind of phenothiazine medication. And one of the side effects of that, of course, is what? And so this guy had taken a bunch, you know, some phenothiazine medicines, and this was all the reason. Once he got that, Dr. Keegstra stood up and he went. And, of course, got some Benadryl, had us give it to him, you know, slow IV. And that guy's neck just went, oh. And the guy jumped up. He was so happy. And he jumped up on his bed, and he jumped off his bed, and he gave Dr. Keegstra a huge kiss in Spanish. He was heading for me, but I'd have none of that. I hit the road. And that, those kind of lessons, as I worked with, you know, these guys, many of them were mission doctors I worked with. Patient, kind, deliberate, worked with what came to them. Those kind of lessons taught me the importance of listening. Do you think Jesus listened to people? Yes, he did, and he wanted to help them. And the only thing that, you know, the problem with Laodicea many times is that we don't listen enough. Throughout Revelation it says, "He that has an ear, let him hear." We've got one ear turned off, you know. And we need to listen. And of course, the message of Laodicea is that we are to buy. Well, how are we to buy? Well, Isaiah says to buy without money, without price. Well, if we can't use money, how can we pay for something? Well, the Puritans used to say, the way you pay is you pay attention. Kind of like that, don't you? Pay attention. And Dr. Keegstra taught me that lesson of paying attention. Now, one other thing. This miracle and the next one are kind of together because they are both miracles that Jesus healed on the Sabbath. Notice the next one. Luke chapter 14, verse 1 through 6. "Now it happened as he went into the house of one of the rulers of the Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath that they watched him closely. And behold, there was a certain man before him who had dropsy. And Jesus answered and spoke to the lawyers and Pharisees and said, 'Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?' But they kept silent. And they took him and healed him and let him go. Then he answered them, saying, 'Which of you, having a donkey or an ox that has fallen into a pit, will not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath day?' And they could not answer him regarding these things." You know, we could get into dropsy and all this, but the thing I want to notice with you is that Jesus took care of people on the Sabbath. How many of you noticed that from these? And these were elective cases. I mean, certainly 18 years of something going wrong, we're not going to rush in and say, "All right, I'm going to take care of it right now." That's been going on for 18 years. And, you know, Jesus could have said 18 years in one day, not that much longer in the main scheme of things. Right? But Jesus went ahead and did it. So what are the implications? Should we open up all the elective surgery clinics and go ahead and do everything like that? How many think that's what we need to do? Probably not that. We also notice, I don't know of anywhere that Jesus was paid for his procedures. How many of you noticed that he was never paid? See, medicine and taking care of people is not a business. That's what they teach you. But it's more akin to a ministry. Are you with me? And so Jesus was in this for the ministry. Now, how does this apply? You know, when I met my wife, two things. First of all, this idea, first of all, I come back to this because I got to show you a couple quotes. Jesus was interested in ministry, not in the money. And in many of the courses and many of the medical schools, many times people, if they're honest, do have underlying this desire to have that stash of cash. I've talked to people about this. And they go through a lot of things, but they're looking for that stack of dead presidents at the end of the tunnel. You know what I mean by dead presidents? Yeah, all the things in your wallet. So, and they work for that. Isn't that right? But Jesus had disinterested benevolence. Many times people confuse, I think, this idea of disinterested benevolence. Sometimes physicians will tell me, and I've talked to them, and they've said, and not just physicians, others, they'll say, look, I don't want to talk about politics or religion with my patients. I don't want to get that close to them, this or that. I'm performing a service, and we need to build their company, and this and that, and let's just move them in, move them out. And some then will tell me that that is disinterested benevolence, because they do things, they don't take an interest in them, but they let them go through. I mean, I've actually had probably 30, 40 people tell me that over the years. So I decided, you know, I better look up that phrase, disinterested benevolence. How many of you have ever studied that? How? It's a number of times it's used. And Jesus and disinterested benevolence. Jesus was presented to me as the perfect pattern. His life was without selfish interests, but ever marked with disinterested benevolence. What I told you about what the physicians were saying or suggesting, what was that? Was that selfish interest or disinterested benevolence? It was definitely a selfish interest. What is disinterested benevolence? Every selfish, covetous person will fall out by the way, like Judas who sold his Lord. They will sell good principles and a noble, generous disposition for a little of earth's gain. All such will be shifted from God's people. Those who want heaven must, with all the energy they possess, be encouraging the principles of heaven. So look, people that are in it for the money, what's going to happen to them? They're going to be shaken out. They're not going to make it. Certainly disinterested benevolence is different than that. And you know, I've come down to understanding that disinterested benevolence. Well, let's look at another couple of quotes and I'll give you the punchline. His example of self-denial and disinterested benevolence was before them. His life of purity, of suffering, of devotion was known to all. Yet this short period of 3 years was as long as the world could endure the presence of their Redeemer. Look, disinterested benevolence, if done right, leads people to want to get rid of you. How can you get a bunch of people that you work with in a partnership to want to get rid of you? Get rid of all their profits. I would suggest that's one way to do it, you know. Don't charge for the time. Don't have billable hours. And I can guarantee you they'll start coming to talk to you. Do you know what I'm talking about? Sure. And I will guarantee you will not last too long in that practice. If you're working with people that aren't interested in disinterested benevolence. Disinterested benevolence is... I'm not going to read more of these quotes. I'm just going to say it. Disinterested benevolence is being so disinterested in yourself that you can be benevolent to that person. And you don't care about yourself and you don't care what they think, so much so that you're willing to share something tactfully but directly about the Lord Jesus Christ. And you could care less what they think of you. but you're reaching out to them. Did Jesus reach out to people in a tactful way, but in a disinterested, benevolent way? Did he do that? He would go the extra mile. That's really disinterested benevolence. Let me ask you a question. Do you think that disinterested benevolence is that which actuates most healthcare systems today? Is managed care another way of saying disinterested benevolence? You know, our early institutions, Ellen White talked about it. She said, should those connected with this enterprise cease to look at their work from a high religious standpoint and descend from the exalted principles of present truth to imitate in theory and practice those at the head of institutions where sick are treated only for the recovery of health, the special blessing of God would not rest on our institution more than upon those where corrupt theories are taught. To the extent that we go away from disinterested benevolence, then what happens to our institutions? The special blessing of God starts to be drawn away. How many of you think that we want the blessing of God in whatever institution we're in, if possible? You see, the key to that is disinterested benevolence. The greatest danger, she continued, a warning was given me against lowering the standard of truth in any way in such an institution in order to help the feelings of unbelievers and thus secure their patronage. The great object of receiving unbelievers into the institution is to lead them to do what? Embrace the truth. That is the purpose of any medical center that's a Seventh-day Adventist medical center. That's the stated purpose from the historical documents. If the standard is lowered, what happens? People will get the impression that the truth is of little importance and they will go away in a state of mind harder of access than before. They're going to be hard-hearted. If this is not the focus, when they leave, they are more resistant than before they came. So that's the little thing about disinterested benevolence. Now let me just say this. One other practical application of that before we go to this next miracle in John 5. My wife, when I met her, she is a dynamo. She is a harnika sprintina ratade de rogue. I mean, she is a Romanesti. I don't even hear speak Romanian. I just slaughtered it and I slaughtered your language and I apologize and I will give you Pamunta Gorda. No one here. Good. Thank you so much. The guy that played this morning was Romanian. Wasn't that beautiful music this morning? Beautiful. Well, anyway, Luminica, that's her name. Luminica means little light. And she just flies all over the place and does different things. And when I met her, man, she was working in this hospital. And, man, it just was love at first sight for me. Took her a while, you know. She had some eye problems. And I did some therapy with her and her father, of course. Oh, boy. Well, that, well, I tell you what, was a blessing, but a blessing in disguise for most of the years. As I started to get to know Luminica, look, I had been in the dating scene. Remember, I'd been bitter in different things. I'm going to tell a little bit at the end here how I got a little more out of that. But by this time, I was converted and I was really ready to settle down. And I made the mistake of telling her, her father, too much stuff about my past, and he was just like comparing me to the sons of Eli. It was a bad situation, and then he was in the family prayers. He was saying things like, "Lord, please protect our family from attacks from without and from within." And I was trying to connect the dots as best as I could, and 5 years later, finally, he saw after I took care of my grandfather for a number of years that I would take care of his daughter, and he gave permission. Anyway, that's another story. I didn't mean to get into that. But as I got to know Luminica, I wanted to be married. Anyone here want to be married and confess it boldly? I'll close my eyes. Were you guys looking around? You were looking around. Well, you guys were looking around. Yes. Anyway, so, I said, look, I can't mess around with people that aren't converted. I have got to have a litmus test to figure out who is as spiritual as Ellen White and as beautiful as you name it. So I said, I've got to have this test. And so I decided my test would be to take the great controversy with me on every date. In fact, to save money, I would read some of the great controversy to the person before the debate. See, kind of see how it went over. Let me tell you, I saved thousands of dollars, probably hundreds of years that way. I remember this one lady, I got out the great controversy and I said, you know, I just was considering this, and she was, I've never seen, I didn't even know she did the hurdles. She was gone. But when I met Luminita, I saw her, she didn't see me, you know. And I went over there and I was sitting down, trying to look obvious with my great controversy. Finally she saw me and I said, so how's it going? And she goes, fine, you know. And she was, we were exchanging pleasantries, and then I said, yeah, I've been reading this book, just reading the book. You know, it's a little more subtle now. Reading the old book. Oh yeah, what you reading? This is the book. What's that book? I said, this is the, what they call the Great Controversy. I expected, you know, some kind of cataclysmic boom, a flash, and she'd be gone. And she goes, the Great Controversy? You read the Great Controversy? I said, yeah, I read the Great Controversy. You heard the Great Controversy? This, unfortunately, was at an Adventist institution, and most people haven't heard of Great Controversy, you know. And she says, I love that book, but what are you reading? And I said, I'm reading the Scriptures of Safeguards. Oh, that's one of my favorite chapters. I said, that's one of your favorite chapters? Will you marry me? No, not quite like that, you know. I was like, wow, man. And, you know, so I said, you know, and I kind of eased into it, you know. I kind of, you know, and I listened to her, and she just said, I said, okay, you just read right here. You just keep reading. And so I went out, and I was actually involved in a Merle game at that time, and I came back to the next sitting, and she's still sitting there reading this chapter, and I was like, this is heaven, sort of, you know. But the problem was, what was the next step, you know? And I heard her over talking, you know, talking to someone else. Why am I telling you all this? This is not related to what I was going to say. But I heard her talking to someone else, and she was talking to someone else, and she said, man, I really wish I could go home to Chicago this weekend because this and that and the other, you know, I'm out there, you know, I'm playing third base, and she's on the bleachers, and I'm going, oh, Chicago, this weekend. As soon as the inning was done, I ran into the next building. Back then, they didn't have cell phones. They didn't even have cars. But I went back in there, and I found the phone, and I called my friend in Chicago. And now his name's Dr. Haugen. And I called him up. I said, Doctor, he was a nurse back then. I said, you know, I'm wanting you to invite me down this weekend. He said, well, sure, Don, you know, you can come down any time. We were planning to be gone this weekend. I said, no, you're not. You're staying there because I need to come down to your house. Well, you're welcome to stay here. No, that won't work. Anyway, you can get out. Well, is it really an emergency? I said, it's, you can consider it an emergency. If you'd like to, that'd be fine with me. It's your choice. Whatever you want to consider it. And he said, well, sure, we'll stay. You know, it's not that big a deal. We'll stay here. I said, thank you very much. Hung up the phone. Went back out there. Sauntered out, you know, slowly. She was still reading the Great Controversy. And so then I casually mentioned to one of my friends. I said, you know, I'm thinking of going to Chicago this weekend. You know, someone else there. And she overheard me. He says, you thinking of going to Chicago this weekend? I said, well, yeah, I don't know if I'm going to have room in my car. Because I just was talking to my friend. But call me later. Took my great controversy away. Man, I hope you're taking some notes here. Because I didn't want to act like I was that interested. I mean, I'm almost blown it with the great controversy thing so many times. And then she called me later up. What do you think about this? And I said, well, I think it's going to work. You can go in the car. And that's how it all started. Great controversy. It's been a blessing to be married to my wife. Well, anyway, as I got to know her better, I saw more and more. I mean, her father and mother had raised her to read the spirit of prophecy. Her parents had escaped from Romania. They understood what it was like to grow up in a place where they had to be willing to die for their faith. Their parents couldn't go to school because they had taken stands for the Sabbath. And so they were very, very, they very much wanted to be following the Lord on the Sabbath. and every other area of life. And they worked in the hospital there, but they made a decision. You know what they made a decision to do? They made a decision that if they had to work on the hospital, and of course in both of these passages we see that it's okay to be taking care of the sick on the Sabbath, amen? But they noticed that Jesus wasn't paid for that, and I was working as a nurse at the time. I never really thought about it. I had my pay, they had their pay. But they said to me, we don't take our money, we put it in a family Sabbath fund. And then we do special things with that. And I was like, wow. Wow. That's kind of extreme. But I began to think about it, and I said, you know, that kind of makes sense. I mean, I'm just there disinterestedly wanting to help people. I didn't even know that whole phraseology then. I said, maybe I'll try it. And I was working in this emergency department at the time. We saw 50,000 patients a year, and usually I'd go in, you know, I'd try and schedule it so I could go in and not have to work on Sabbath, but many times I'd have to go in and different things. And so I'd say, okay, great. If I go in, I'm just going to go ahead and put that money aside, just like they did. So I began to put the money aside, and that started to add up. That money added up pretty quick. I had all this money, you know. So what am I going to do with this money? Well, I'm not going to go, you know, on a vacation. That didn't seem right. I need to be giving it back maybe to the church, but that seemed to, you know, I wanted to see the money work a little more. So I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to sit here in the emergency room, and anybody that doesn't have insurance or this or that, I'm going to go ahead, and I ain't going to use my funds, and I'm going to go ahead and buy them some medicine or this or that. I'm just going to kind of do it softly. Can you do those kind of things softly? So I'm sitting there, and I buy this person that, and the other person that. And I was working in Benton Harbor, Michigan at the time. And the word started to get around. And more people started to be calling up and saying, is Don there at work? As soon as they found out, you know, a car would come up. Another car would come up. Pretty soon. You know, all these Sabbath miracles. Have you noticed in the Sabbath miracles when Jesus was doing his healing that all kinds of people started to mob him? Have you noticed that? They'll do the same thing if you're handing out money, I found out. And this started working this way. Now, if I had to do it over again, I wouldn't have done it that way. I wouldn't have started giving out money like that, because that just drew attention, and it was probably not good for them, probably not good for me. But I was trying to do my best. Well, I arrived at work. This was the last Sabbath that I worked at that institution. I arrived at work, and I was to be in free lunch, and they had already found out I was there, and there was a line going from the door of the emergency room all the way around the sidewalk, about 20 feet down. And all those people were waiting for me to get to work. And so my boss called me in. And she said, Don, we really appreciate you. We really do. But I have some good news for you and some bad news for you. I said, well, what's the good news? Your job is safe and secure here. You know you don't have to worry about that. We love working with you. But I'm sorry to tell you that you cannot work here on from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday anymore.
Hallelujah!
Now, I went in a few other times because of, you know, accidents and different things. But, you know, over the years, my mind has gone back to that. And God honors, I believe, He has honored me in my experience with that commitment. Now, I don't know what that would be for you, but there are several physicians in my church that they have had this same understanding. And you know what they've done? They've had a resource that's behind the scenes, but it's... We call it a medical emergency fund, and we use it for people behind the scenes. And you know how great a blessing that has been to people. They've helped subsidize community health programs in the city. I can point to at least 15 people in my church who that hand was put out in a way that it couldn't have been put out otherwise with that Sabbath money, which is all of it's God's money, isn't it? And it's been used in a way that have brought people into the kingdom. Yes.
Now I'm much more wise about it. We have a committee. I'm not sitting out there in front of the church handing out money on Sabbath morning. That's not the secret too. That would be a great tool for church growth, but I don't recommend it. And all I want to say to you is, and I'm serious about this, if you honor God with disinterested benevolence concerning the Sabbath in your lives, you will see fruit in the kingdom for you. You need to be wise about it. Is that something that you've thought about before? Probably have. But I just want to commend that to your thoughts. It's been a real blessing. Now the last Sabbath miracle I want to look at with you, John chapter 5, verse 1 through 9. John chapter 5 and verse 1 through 9. It's been great looking at these miracles, hasn't it? Kind of milking them for a few thoughts. We haven't exhaustively gone through them. John chapter 5, verse 1 through 9. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porches. In these lay a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down at a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water. Then whoever stepped in first after stirring up the water was made well of whatever disease he had. And now a certain man was there who had had an infirmity for 38 years. And when Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been in that condition a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" The sick man answered him and said, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. But while I am coming, another steps in before me." And Jesus said to him, "Rise, take up your bed and walk." And immediately the man was made well, took up his bed and walked. And that day was the Sabbath. Isn't that a great miracle as well? Now, there's a lot of things we could talk about in that miracle. But, you know, some people that have studied this text, they say this person had paralysis for a number of years. What was the problem? And I listened to one person talking about this that thought the person maybe had developed a tertiary syphilis or some kind of problem like this. All kinds of unique ideas I've heard. But there was some kind of reason they came with this, and I can't remember why. Maybe some hint in the spirit of prophecy that I can't remember. I'm not going to vouch for that. But the simple fact was there was paralysis. And there was paralysis that was connected with an overanalysis on the man's part. I mean, you know, he was analyzing this and that, and he had some self-pity and all these different things. But I think Jesus' question is what I want to deal with here, and sort of what I want to close this message off with. With maybe yet another illustration, kind of finishing up on Friday night's theme. This question that Jesus asks is really a key question when we're dealing with people and when God is dealing with us. And you notice the question that he asked? Do you want to be made well? Have you ever seen patients or people, or have you ever had family members that really don't want to be made well? Has that ever been frustrating to you? How about your family members? If you talk to them and I was talking to them, would they say that maybe there's some people in this room that maybe just don't want to be made well? You know, I told you the other night as I was closing that one of the biggest objectives I had on this weekend was that we would start to address this issue of bitterness, because I think it's something we all deal with. And I told you when we got to the end of our time, oops, I ran out of time, and I think it was after that lady had been had died and I had prayed for her there in the hospital, how I still was bitter when I left and that I just couldn't let go of it. You know, when I used to work in the ER, they had these, they probably, everything's all new now. They probably don't even have patient beds anymore. I don't know. But when I used to work there, they had put in these brand new Space Lab monitors. They were no longer Hewlett-Packard monitors, but they were Space Lab monitors, and you could touch them and then push the button, and now, you know, then it would, this strip would come out. Now it just goes right into your chart, probably, right out the monitor and everything, you know. I'm surprised the patient even has to come in, you know. But you had to put these strips down and different things.
And the monitor would understand what the normal rhythm of that patient was, even if it was hokey, a little hokey, you know. And as soon as it went away off from that at all the bells would go out. And you know, about 9 times out of 10, there was nothing wrong with the person. They had just scratched an itch or, you know, moved a little bit or something. But the monitor thought, that's not normal. That's not how they usually act. And that's the way people are in life. Even if it is something that you're doing wrong, you can be in the most miserable type of relationship. You can be involved with things that are just not right. But you get used to it. And then when it changes a little bit, you go back to that even though it's not good for you. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about. And this was my situation. And I was in a mess. You know, I think that when we get a root of bitterness, sometimes it's true that it's kind of like a sheep that's fallen down and can't get up again. You know, the psalmist says, oh, my soul, why are you cast down and disquieted in me? And this idea of being cast down for a sheep was they couldn't get up again without some kind of help. They needed some push, some motivation. And you know, I think this is the important thing about Christian witnessing and reaching out to your friends and talking with others and also for preaching and for teaching and interaction, exhorting one another. Because sometimes it can help you get out of a situation that you would otherwise not get out of. Don't you think that's true? I love to listen to sermons. Do you like to listen to sermons? I love to listen to sermons. I like 5 or 10 sermons a week. I've got my headphones on. You know, when I get down, I get C.D. Brooks out. Whoa, man! He gets me going. I say, thank you, C.D. Then I slip in a little E.E. Cleveland just to put a cherry on top. Anybody here listen to C.D. Brooks? Hey, that guy's a preacher. Woo! Man. And this is the whole idea, because this helps us get out of ruts. And in my bitterness and my anger, I left that hospital and I took off and I went down to South America and I said, I'm just going to go down to South America. And of course I went with an individual, went down there, and I got down there and I was there in Venezuela. I was in Caracas and I was walking around Caracas and I was... This is a very affluent family, and I was with this family. I was up in the high rise in their place, and I was looking down, and on a certain day of the week, they have Polar Bear there. Has anyone ever been to Caracas here? And they had that company, Polar Bear, I think, Polar Bear. Isn't that kind of like an ice cream bar or something? Anyway, strike that from the record. Polar Beer, and I was looking up there and they had happy hour a couple days a week, and at happy hour all these people would smash into each other, all these cars and everything else, they're all laughing. I'm going, these people, what, this is crazy, what am I doing here? But I go down on the street because I want to walk around. I walk around the street and the last thing I remember is gringo. You know what a gringo is? Somebody from up north that goes down south to Venezuela. And so I got beat up. But I didn't feel most of it till later. And so then I said, man, I'm going home. So I go home. And all the while, you know, I was struggling with this whole thing. So I go home. I go back to New York. I get out there in New York. And I kiss the earth because I'm in New York. Finally home, safe in New York. And then I get a cab. And the guy rips me out for $75. So I said, all right. I'm going to go down to Florida and I'll get a job down there. So I loaded up my diesel Volkswagen Rabbit. We drive excitement. And headed on down to Florida. Chugga, chugga, chug. And I went down there and I got a job. Interviewed for the job, did well in all the different things, got the job. But I couldn't bring myself to take the job. Then I went to the next hospital. I got another job up near St. Augustine. I couldn't take that job for some reason. I said, I can't take this job. I did that like 10 times. I went to these hospitals. I got these jobs and I couldn't take the job. What was happening? God was, you know, what's it say? in Psalm 32, isn't it? When I kept silent, my bones grew old through all my groaning all the day long, for your hand was heavy, heavy upon me. And this lady's prayer, the one who I had prayed for there in the hospital, kept coming back to me and haunting me. What doest thou here was kind of what was happening, and I kept just going this place and that place, and I could commit to nothing. So finally I said, you know, I am not going to go back because I simply do not want to change how I feel about my father. I simply don't think life is worth that. I am not interested. And I came to the decision that I would end my life. Now, for me, that sounds unbelievable to you, probably. But I came to the decision nonetheless. And in North Carolina, there was a huge windstorm going on, and I said, I'm going to go walk off and jump off that pier. So I parked the diesel rabbit and got my things in order. I started to walk down the pier, and as I was walking towards the pier, two men came up to me who were interested in each other and other men, and they propositioned me. Now, that's the first time I'd ever been propositioned. And I thought, you know, is this the way to go out? Just before you're about ready to die, these people, you know, proposition you. I said, man, this is bad, real bad. Really bad. So I started to walk further out on the pier. And then this overwhelming sense came over me. Remember, I was still a self-avowed atheist. But it was based on bitterness, now that I understand it. I stopped there and I said, you know, this whole issue of wanting to be made well. No, I didn't want to be made well. I wanted to end my life. I stopped for a minute. You know, I said, you know, my mom has always been kind and loving to me. My mom has always been there for me. My mom has always been understanding. You know, I really can't do this without calling my mom first. This would not be right. I mean, when you think about it, which is crueler, calling your mom first or not calling her at all? I think it's probably cruel both ways, right? So I go back and I found this payphone. It's raining and different things, and I have a quarter and some different things, and I call, and if it was going to be my dad, I'm going to hang up. If it's my mom, I'm going to talk to her. Because I'm calling collect. And I call up, and my mom answers the phone. And my mom's crying on the phone. And she says, Donnie, where are you? I think you're in danger. I've been praying for you all day. Where are you? Said, I'm in North Carolina. She said, are you okay? I said, not really, Mom. She says, come home. Don't tell me about it. Tell me about it when you come home. Come home right now. Come home. Will you come home? I said, Mom, I don't know that I want to come home. She said, please come home. And there was just tears in her voice. I love you. I want you to come home. And I hung up the phone. And I went home. Let me ask you a question. Do you think God cares for you? Do you think He knows your situation? Do you think that He can work through anyone who opens their life to Him to reach you? I'm so thankful my mom was in tune with the Lord that day. And as I drove home, all of these ideas about there not being a God, I just couldn't believe that my mom would know that. That was not coincidence to me. And as I drove through Ohio, I began to sing, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. Little ones, to Him belongs. They are weak, but He is strong. You mothers out there, or potential mothers, your prayers are very meaningful. Your love for your children is very meaningful. And you fathers, it is for you too. Now, do you suppose that when I got home, everything just worked out fine? Or do you think the devil was a little upset that I had made this decision that I wanted to be well? No, the devil attacked it. He attacked it. I want to tell you a little bit of that story, but I don't know if I should do that now. I'll tell it to you tonight. But let me just leave you with this thought. I believe in the power of intercessory prayer. I believe that Jesus, in that first Sabbath miracle, when it says that the Father proclaimed, "This is my beloved Son," when Jesus had the victorious experience of the power of the Spirit, and through the power of faith coming into His experience by repeating the Scriptures there of that 40 days, and then His demonstration through the miracles, I believe all those things happened because of His prayer life. And I believe all of those situations where these people's minds were changed, all of this psychosurgery, if you will, was done many times beforehand, long before early in the morning. Do you think it's true? And one of my favorite texts is this. It's in Isaiah 50. And maybe you know it from memory, maybe you've committed it from memory.